weren't any ice stations in the very beginning, and in the past 6 months it's increasing, and their strategies and their tactics have become more and more aggressive and assertive.
Confusion, anger, and waiting will take you inside a typical day in a New York immigration court.
From Monday, August 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, a tale of two Washington, D.C.s.
There is a wide range of views in the nation's capital on President Trump's moves to take over D.C. police and deploy the National Guard.
Obviously, we're not in the middle of a giant riot or anything that would necessitate having the National Guard here.
Also, tennis legend Serena Williams is making headlines.
This time, not for dominance on the court, but for her decision to take weight loss medication.
It's really, really difficult to exist in a body and to feel secure in your body, but also to just also feel like you can exist in the world free of discrimination and harm.
That conversation after this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Democratic Maryland Congressman Glenn Ivey is accusing the Trump administration of abusing its power when it comes to the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia.
It's outrageous that the Trump administration is transforming the Department of Justice into a Department of Retribution. And this is yet another example of them abusing the power of the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security.
Congressman Ivey speaking to reporters after Abrego Garcia was detained again this morning when he reported for a scheduled interview at a federal immigration office in Baltimore. He's now being detained in Virginia. At a hearing in the case today, a federal judge extended a temporary restraining order barring the government from deporting Abrego Garcia from the U.S. to Uganda. Abrego Garcia was returned to the U.S. in June after his mistaken deportation to his home country of El Salvador. He now faces human smuggling charges that his lawyers dismiss as preposterous. Current and former employees of the Federal Emergency Management Agency say FEMA is not ready to respond to hurricanes and other disasters. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports that 181 people signed a letter to Congress with the warning.
The letter comes days before the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. In the wake of Katrina, Congress passed reforms to FEMA, including a requirement that the agency's director have emergency management experience. Now, a group of current and former FEMA employees says the Trump administration is undercutting the agency's readiness to respond to disasters. Among other concerns, they note that FEMA's current leader has no experience with disasters. In a statement, FEMA's acting press secretary, Daniel Yarguez, wrote that the administration is, quote, committed to ensuring FEMA delivers for the American people. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Firefighters in the Pacific Northwest are facing extreme temperatures that will likely continue into midweek. In Central Oregon, the Flat Fire is threatening hundreds of homes. Two U.S. lawmakers, a Republican and a Democrat, visited Syria today and say they will push ahead with legislation to lift sanctions. Their goal is to give Syria's president a boost, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Republican Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina says he was impressed by Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara, a former jihadi fighter.
He is a positive individual. He is dedicated to the people of Syria.
He and Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen met with Syrians from various ethnic and religious backgrounds to hear what kind of future they want.
They want to see it unified, but they want to see that their rights are going to be protected. They want to feel safe and secure in the country, and they want the United States to lift the sanctions.
She's sponsoring legislation in the Senate to do that, while Wilson is doing the same in the House. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
And you're listening to NPR News. Israel is acknowledging a military strike in the area of a hospital in southern Gaza. Officials say at least 20 people were killed when Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis was attacked, including five journalists. They were killed in a second strike as they rushed to the scene of the first. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says the strike was a tragic mishap and that the military is investigating. A massive rocket called Starship is scheduled to blast off in a couple of hours on its 10th test flight. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports. That attempt to launch on Sunday was called off just as the rocket was being fueled up.
The two-stage, nearly 400-foot-tall rocket was being filled with liquid methane and liquid oxygen at the launch site in Texas when SpaceX workers suddenly stopped and drained the tanks. Elon Musk posted on social media that a ground-side liquid oxygen leak needed to be fixed and that they would aim for another launch attempt on Monday. The space community has been waiting for this 10th test flight with a lot of interest because the Starship program has suffered a string of failures this year. One of the rockets even exploded on the launch pad during a test. And this rocket is a key part of NASA's effort to return astronauts to the surface of the moon. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
American Madison Keys has been knocked out of the final Grand Slam tennis tournament of the year. Keys was upset at the U.S. Open today, losing her first round match in New York to 82nd ranked Renata Cerezo of Mexico. Keys won her first major championship, the Australian, back in January. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour on this Monday afternoon, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. And looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy, lows 41 to 45. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76.
NPR News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in New York.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. When someone is in the country without legal status, they may be given a notice to appear before an immigration judge. And the courts where they go have become flashpoints of one of the Trump administration's signature domestic policies, mass deportations. And some of the most public displays of enforcement are happening in New York City. NPR immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo takes us inside.
I'm standing outside 26 Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan. There are barriers blocking portions of the street. Police cars lined up and a mix of people making their way into the building. Many of them are dressed in nice clothes and are clutching files of paperwork for their hearings. There are also activists, community members, journalists, and sometimes even elected officials and clergy. It's quite chaotic, and there's a palpable anxiety. I'm here in New York because two federal buildings have become notorious for violent scenes of people being detained by masked federal agents. And their job is to make arrests of people coming in for routine immigration court appointments. As I go inside those same federal buildings in Lower Manhattan, it's quiet today. Lawyers and immigration advocates inside say people are afraid. Benjamin Remy, an immigration lawyer, is in court almost every day. Now, many are too scared to show up, he says.
People are being put into an absolutely impossible situation, right? They're being forced to gamble their own liberty versus potentially continuing with their case, continuing with their claim. So in terms of a reduction in the amount of people showing up, absolutely, absolutely.
The Manhattan courthouse halls have been one of the epicenters of such arrests.
Move, move, move!
The scuffles have gone on for weeks. Members of the public have been pushed out by federal officials who say that they're making it harder for them to work. Here, you can hear the protests against the arrests. Earlier in the month, the building was cleared out after immigration officers found an unknown white powder in their offices. Officials say it came with a threatening note telling officers, quote, "Nobody can escape from karma, not even you." The regular threats of violence and arrests contribute to the court's overall vibe of disorganization. The noise of individual migrants' cases can be heard out of open doors, people nervously tapping their feet. In other places, those waiting cry. A woman tells me that she's here for her husband, who was afraid that he would be detained if he came in person. And one by one, migrants from Colombia, Guyana, India admit to being in the country illegally. They have to return for their next appointments in 2029. A date 4 years from now has become a regular feature in courts across the country as immigration judges juggle a 3.7 million case backlog. John Sarabella from the New Sanctuary Coalition has been coming to these courts once a week for 6 months, and he says it wasn't always this way.
There weren't any ICE agents in the very beginning, and in the past 6 months, it's increasing. And their strategies and their tactics have become more and more aggressive and assertive over the past 6 months.
He said he sees arrests almost every time he comes. The scene in these courts is replayed every day on each floor, while the judge ticks through the same set of questions federal agents mill in the doorways. They're wearing masks and sunglasses. Periodically, they can be seen escorting someone around the corner once their hearing is over. Those people then disappear, likely into an ICE detention center.
That was NPR's Ximena Bustillo reporting there. And Ximena joins us now for more on this story. Hi, Ximena.
Hi, Elsa.
So I understand that you personally experienced some uncertainty of not knowing who's in charge inside these courtrooms or even who's allowed public access. What happened to you exactly?
Mm-hmm. On some floors of the building, we were told that we couldn't even be in public spaces, limited only to the blue carpet in front of elevators because we were journalists.
So we can be like in the blue?
Yeah, that's it.
But we can't be in the halls?
No.
Can I be in the hall if she stays in the blue?
No, you guys are press, no.
Press is, what about public?
Public, yes.
On other floors, we were told we could be in waiting areas but not recording, and other times we were told to completely leave. While I was sitting in a courtroom at 290 Broadway in the middle of a public hearing, I was told to leave, even though the judge had said her chambers were open to the public, including the press.
Wait, so were you allowed back in?
The court clerk a few minutes later did allow me to come back in, and federal agents who had originally asked me to leave were still lingering in the doorway, looking inside the room. And keep in mind that this is all happening while someone's immigration hearing is still ongoing. And you can hear a court official then come over and slam the door on the agents. The agents start banging on the door to be let back in. There's a clear tension over who exactly is in charge here. Is it the courts? Is it ICE? Or is it court security who's contracted by a totally different part of DHS? I spoke with Remy, the immigration lawyer, about this tension between agencies, and here's what he said.
It's just to see this institution that we've been arguing cases in, that we've been representing people in for years and years, essentially just be eviscerated by the Department of Homeland Security in a matter of months has been absolutely surreal.
And Ximena, I understand that you went back the next day. Can you explain what happened then? Like, did you have another confrontation?
Mm-hmm. I went back to the same floor the next morning, and court security this time allowed me to walk around and sit where I wanted to in the public spaces. And as I was doing this, I noticed a man in a green plaid shirt, jeans, and a cap. And he was sitting among those waiting to be called for their hearings. But it appeared that he was undercover law enforcement, since he later joined about five other agents, most masked, with vests labeled police or just federal police. And let me paint the scene of what happened next. At one point, I opened the double doors to go into the hall and almost run into the agents. That plaid shirted man turns around and yells at me to stop effing following him. I identify myself as a journalist and say I'm in a public space. Then a court observer starts getting into it with the same man, and she says she is not effing following him. He grabs her arm, and at this point, I take my phone out and start recording.
Don't touch me, okay? Why are you pushing? Are you stopping me? I'm in the corner. Why are you pushing me? I'm not touching you. I'm not following you.
You can hear her ask, why are you shoving me? Him asking, why are you following me? Her say that I'm not following you. And he says, hands behind your back. He takes her into a service elevator bay, and the yelling continues for a few minutes.
Why are you shoving me? I'm not following you around. Everything's about you.
I can't see what's happening, but I can hear what sound like handcuffs. Within minutes, they all leave down the elevator, and I still don't know what happened to the court observer or even her name. I'm trying to find it.
Wow. I mean, Ximena, what do you think the big picture takeaway is here from everything that you have seen in these courtrooms in New York?
You know, immigrant advocates say what I witnessed counts as quiet days in those buildings. But it also, you know, shows how easy it is for regular people to get caught up in this. A journalist who turns the corner at the wrong moment, or a court observer that catches an agent, you know, when he has a lot of tension running through him. The agency that's in charge of immigration courts referred questions on building access to DHS and declined to comment on questions regarding the incidents and clashes between public, press, and law enforcement in their spaces that at this point have been ongoing for weeks. I reached out to DHS and I did not get a response. You know, this example shows just how often the rules are changing and how who is in charge can really change on a given day and a given person. And immigrants and others are often caught in the crosshairs.
That is NPR immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo. Thank you so much, Ximena.
Thank you.
Today marked one of the deadliest days for press in Gaza, and it comes exactly 2 weeks after an Israeli airstrike had targeted a press tent, killing six journalists, including a popular reporter for Al Jazeera. In today's attack, five Palestinian journalists working for international media were killed at a hospital complex. And NPR's Aya Batraoui and Anas Baba have this report, and a warning, it does include the sound of gunfire.
Reuters cameraman Hossam al-Masri was operating a live feed with a bird's eye view of Israeli tanks nearby. He was at the top of an open stairwell at the Nasser Medical Complex in southern Gaza when, at around 10 a.m., the live feed cut. An Israeli missile had struck him, killing al-Masri on the spot. Journalists and first responders at the hospital rushed to the top of the stairwell. On the ground, a camera for the Al-Ghad news channel zoomed in, capturing what came next. A second Israeli attack, this time from a tank, hit the stairwell. The back-to-back strikes killed at least 22 people. The Israeli military acknowledged the attacks, but didn't identify a target. It said an initial inquiry would be conducted soon and that the military does not intentionally target journalists. The prime minister's office said Israel regrets the, quote, tragic mishap, but offered no further details on what accountability there might be. At the hospital, journalists and others mourn those killed, which included a first responder, a medical resident, and hospital staff. Palestinian journalists count more than 245 members of the press killed in Israeli attacks in Gaza, all in under 2 years of war. Among the five journalists killed today was Mariam Abuldakka, a contributor to the Associated Press. Abuldakka's last photos for AP showed emaciated, severely malnourished children in Gaza. In the final video of herself shared on Instagram, the 33-year-old stands in front of a mirror, taking deep breaths to the backdrop of a song about ascending to heaven. She looks gaunt and pale, a glimpse of the starvation and exhaustion journalists face in Gaza. The AP says Abuldakka evacuated her 13-year-old son out of Gaza early in the war and hadn't seen him since. The Committee to Protect Journalists says that, quote, Israel's broadcasted killing of journalists in Gaza represents, quote, the most horrific attacks the press has ever faced in recent history. This as Israel continues to block independent access to Gaza for foreign journalists. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Khan Yunis, Gaza.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com.
On today's date, August 25th, 1992, I notice the first jack-in-the-pulpit berries are ripe. Bright red berries in a thick column. The leaves are fading fast, kind of drooping, but the berries are exquisite. Usually about this time of year, I pick those same berries and break them off of the little pod and cast them about, help them get a start, help them to grow into new jack-in-the-pulpit plants. I've got quite a patch now. The interesting thing about jack-in-the-pulpit is that the more robust and vigorous they are, the more apt they are to be female. And in conversely, when they are weakened and in a poor state, they may become male, and they can switch back and forth between male and female each year as their conditions dictate. But this time of year, Those bright red berries are certainly easy to spot. And as you break them off of the structure underneath, note the color of the structure. The few times that I have done this, the structure underneath has been a lovely purple. Enjoy, and don't eat the berries. They're full of a dangerous chemical called calcium oxalate. It won't kill you, but you'll be ever so sorry if you try to eat one.
NPR comes from the station. And from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing the number 27-MEDICARE. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Tennis legend Serena Williams is making headlines again, but this time it's not about her dominance on the court. It's about her decision to take a GLP-1 weight loss medication. Williams revealed last week that after struggling to shed postpartum weight, even with intense training and healthy eating, she turned to a GLP-1 treatment. According to People magazine, she says she lost over 31 pounds. Along with her decision, she was announced as the new face of a national campaign for the telehealth company Roe. Her husband also serves on that company's board. And this has all sparked a sometimes tense conversation about the scrutiny of women's bodies, weight stigma, and body autonomy. Chrissy King has been writing and talking about these topics for some time. She's the author of The Body Liberation Project, How Understanding Racism and Diet Culture Helps Cultivate Joy and Build Collective Freedom. And she joins us now. Chrissy, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Juan. I'm excited to be here with you.
Excited to talk with you. Chrissy, can you just start by telling us, what was your first reaction when you saw that Serena Williams was announced that she was going to be sort of a new face of these GLP-1 weight loss drugs, at least for this one company, Roe?
I think when I first saw it, I had like a myriad of emotions at one time. I think there was definitely a little bit of like an element of surprise, but also an element of like, oh, actually, I could totally see this. And I think my biggest initial thought is like, oh, I can see how this is going to spark massive conversation. And it's such a nuanced topic that needs to be handled with so much care. And I can see how that's going to be missed in a lot of places.
Yeah. You've written about the history of how Serena Williams has been very specifically body shamed over the years, even as she kept winning Grand Slams, picking up Olympic medals, stunning the tennis world. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of constant public scrutiny that she's faced over the years and why it matters in this conversation?
Having her be this high-performing athlete that is achieving all of these things and is doing so much, but her body still being the topic of a conversation to the fact that she's being called a gorilla and has always been hypersexualized, all of those things play a really important part in the conversation we're having. And so I think that when we're talking about this conversation of her usage of GLP-1s to make her body smaller, I also can see why that's not surprising if your body has always been talked about in this way. Yeah. And now you finally feel like you can achieve this thing that maybe could silence all this conversation about, you know, your body once and for all. And I think ironically, it's done the opposite, right? Because now we're talking about it more than ever.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that the discourse, when we talk about our bodies, about Black women's bodies, we know that the discourse is different. So it does make me wonder, Chrissy, do you think if the new face of these drugs had been a white woman rather than a Black woman, that the discourse, the reaction would be different?
Actually, yes, I very much do think it would be different. And I think about the fact that, like, Charles Barkley has been a spokesperson for this drug for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And I've really heard no conversation about that, right? And so I think it goes into play about the intersection of sexism, of racism, of fat phobia, and being a Black woman that lives at the intersection of all those things, that you almost are held to this higher standard, right? And this, you have this higher responsibility. It feels like that people hold you to a different standard. And I do think that if this weight loss drug had been the face, anybody else had been the face, if it had been a white woman, if it had been somebody else, we would be having an entirely different conversation. I think that is the part that I do find most frustrating, is because when you're a Black woman that has been harmed by sexism, by fat phobia, by racism, you've had to like already face all of those things in your life. And now you're somehow seen as the antagonist of this situation that's occurring when really you've been the victim of all of these systems of oppression the entire time.
Chrissy King is author of The Body Liberation Project, How Understanding Racism and Diet Culture Helps Cultivate Joy and Build Collective Freedom. She also writes the weekly Substack newsletter, The Liberation Collective. Chrissy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Ashley Ludlow. For as long as Ludlow can remember, her mother Judy struggled with mental illness. In 2005, Judy attempted to take her own life. As soon as Ludlow and her family found out, they wanted to rush to Florida to be by her side. But Hurricane Katrina made it impossible for them to get there right away.
For anyone that has lost a loved one to suicide, you know how difficult this is. All of the mixed emotions, the guilt, the sadness. I didn't want my mom to suffer, but I also didn't want my mom to end up living not as herself. That is not what she would have wanted at all. I did ask, since I was medical power of attorney, if I could please make my mom a DNR, which is a do not resuscitate order, so that if she stopped breathing, they wouldn't try to get her back again. And I knew, based on what she had written out, that those were her wishes. But having to tell someone that out loud was agonizing. I was heartbroken, and the decision made me feel like that I myself was ending my mom's life. About 6 p.m. on August 30th, 2005, I got a call telling me that my mom had passed away. It was so difficult, and I still felt so guilty and responsible. About a week later, I got a call that changed everything. A male nurse that had worked in the ICU at this hospital in Jacksonville, Florida, called to tell me that he had been one of the ones that had taken care of my mother, and that my mother had never woken up, showed zero signs of pain, and passed away peacefully. And he took the time to call me days later to tell me this information and to let me know that the difficult decision that I had to make for my mom was indeed the right one. I don't remember this guy's name, but I do remember how he made me feel and how he changed my life by letting me know that my mom was at peace. This was such a gift that I was not expecting at all, but still to this day, 20 years later, makes me so thankful.
Listener Ashley Ludlow, if you or someone you know is struggling with mental health challenges, you can call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline 24/7 at 988 or online at 988lifeline.org. And you can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pokegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. United Way of 1,000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A number of street signs in Northern Ireland, which include the island's indigenous language, have been damaged throughout the summer. And now, police are investigating the incidents as hate crimes, as Sean McPullen reports.
Several dual-language street signs in the Irish county of Tyrone were recently damaged or defaced with paint. Police investigators believe the destruction may have been motivated by prejudice and could arrest the perpetrators under Northern Ireland's unique hate crime laws. The Irish language is also under attack in the country's courts. Plans to install signs with the indigenous language at Belfast's new Grand Central Station may be canceled. Next month, a judge will hear a lawsuit by a far-right activist to stop the new signs. Both issues will soon be addressed by the country's first Irish language commissioner, who is expected to be confirmed in the coming weeks. This new role is thought to be a litmus test for the British government, which historically discriminated against the language. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.
For decades, Albuquerque locals have been going to the Indian Pueblo Kitchen for indigenous cuisine. Starting this week, visitors can get a taste of the Southwest without even leaving the airport. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
First opening its doors in 1976, the restaurant was reimagined in 2020.
Every Pueblo has a different style of what they cook, what they make.
Chef Josh Aragon is from the Laguna Pueblo and heads the kitchen at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center on tribal land in the heart of Albuquerque.
It's just a combination of all the Pueblos put together, all 19, as a matter of fact. And what comes out of the food is the smiles, the thoughts, the full bellies.
From fry bread and enchiladas to daily hand-baked goods, like Pueblo pies, tortillas, and lots of loaves of bread.
Yesterday I did 3 batches, so about 104 plus 240 dough balls.
Rita Toledo is the head baker. She's from the Jemez Pueblo and now has to prepare even more fresh dishes to feed hungry customers at Albuquerque International Sunport.
The bread we bake, somebody's going to take somewhere out of state. That's exciting.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Western Michigan University is launching a Native American Elders in Residence program. The new program is intended to bridge the generational gap between students and indigenous leaders at the university. The university received an award from the Native American Heritage Fund to launch the program called Sharing Wisdom Across Generations. Western's Native American Affairs Council is consulting with elders and tribal councils of the 3 Potawatomi Nations in Southwest Michigan. Dr. D. Sherwood, director of the Native American Affairs Council, says, elders have vast knowledge. They may have attended a boarding school, lived on the reservation their whole life, or maybe have experience as a veteran or an entrepreneur, and that the program offers the opportunity to learn from older generations for both Native and non-Native students. 3 elders will hold regular office hours. They'll also participate in 10 events over the next year, which could range from drum workshops, beadwork and ribbon skirt making, or talking circles. Next month, the university will be recognized alongside 10 other educational and community organizations selected for grants by the Native American Heritage Fund. The clothing brand For Kinship is hosting a youth event next week at the Navajo Nation Fair in Window Rock, Arizona, called Good Medicine Youth Day. During the event, 2,000 skateboards and wellness items will be distributed to families. The brand helped build a skate park in a Navajo community with skateboarder Tony Hawk and has given away thousands of skateboards across the Navajo Nation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum,
a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. Support by the Colorado Plateau Foundation, supporting Native-led initiatives protecting plateau lands, waters, and cultures by building networks, community, and organizational capacity. Grant proposals accepted through September 5th at coloradoplateaufoundation.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in New York.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Nearly 8 in 10 people in Washington, D.C. oppose the president's takeover of the police department, according to a recent poll conducted by the Washington Post. In interviews with NPR, many say that crime is a legitimate problem, and they welcome more law enforcement. But they worry that President Trump is using it for his own ends. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Washington.
When Nancy Barnes first heard the president wanted to take over the D.C. police and deploy the National Guard, she hated the idea.
I thought that was absurd, and I thought it would not happen.
Why did you think it was absurd?
Because obviously we're not in the middle of a giant riot or anything that would necessitate having the National Guard here.
Barnes is a former public school drama teacher. She lives in a gentrifying neighborhood on the edge of Capitol Hill. Barnes generally feels safe here, but she also says it can be a free-for-all. Several weeks ago, someone drove a motorcycle down the sidewalk, nearly ran her down. On Friday evenings, upwards of 20 men roar down the street on deafening ATVs, which are illegal in D.C. When Barnes heard federal agents had arrested an ATV driver earlier this month, she had a visceral reaction.
I couldn't help it, like it came from my toes. Oh my God, someone arrested an ATV driver, that's amazing! I just felt like someone was doing something.
Barnes knows many other neighborhoods face far greater risks. She also says she'd love to see more law enforcement. Barnes posted her thoughts on Facebook. A friend of hers, DJ Paul, responded sarcastically. Here, he read from his post.
Yeah, let's call in the military because of these quality of life issues you mentioned. That seems like a reasonable response.
Barnes had never suggested that, and Paul later apologized, adding this in an interview with NPR.
This administration is tapping into something that existed already. They're not fabricating something. People don't feel safe.
Just a 12-minute drive away lies the Deanwood neighborhood. Last February, two people were shot to death in a dilapidated apartment building with blown-out windows. Justina Wilkins-Jordan is sitting on the porch of her hair salon here.
There's a lot of shootings going on. There's a lot of congregation of young people just starting fights. And the drug transactions is really heavy.
Like Nancy Barnes, she wants more security on the streets.
I feel that it's needed to clean up and to be safe in this community.
But Wilkins-Jordan says she hasn't seen any federal officers in her neighborhood. Even as she welcomes more law enforcement, she says she doesn't trust the president's motives. Wilkins-Jordan thinks he's using Washington's crime problem to expand his power and undermine the city's Democratic leadership.
I think that he wants to destroy the Democratic Party. He knows that he can go into these cities that runs by a Democrat and control it and say, hey, we don't need Democrats. They are not doing an effective job.
If President Trump were sitting in this chair right now, what would you tell him?
I would say, President Trump, sit down and listen. It's not all about you and the Republicans. You can't control the world. I feel that right now the reason why he's doing it, because he definitely wants to be a dictator.
President Trump insists he's just trying to protect people from what he says is a crime emergency in Washington, even though the U.S. Justice Department has said violent crime here fell to a 30-year low in 2024.
The press says he's a dictator, he's trying to take over. No, all I want is security for our people.
D. D.C. police crime data shows no reported homicides since August 14th and no carjackings in the past week. On the drive back to the office, I came across a fresh crime scene. I spoke with police. Some were laying down white cards on the sidewalk to mark where a half a dozen shell casings had landed.
I'm Frank. I'm with NPR. What happened?
Some shots fired.
Did anyone get shot?
No.
Witnesses told me two men opened fire at each other across an intersection in front of an auto mechanic shop. Kamben Boma owns the place.
You know, some adolescent guys, they're just going crazy, doing wild stuff.
Have you seen any FBI or National Guard around here?
No.
And how quickly did the D.C. police respond to the shooting?
3 minutes. In 2 minutes, they were here.
So do you think D.C. needs the National Guard and the FBI doing this stuff on crime?
Not to my knowledge.
Unlike Wilkins Jordan, Obama says police around here are responsive. He thinks they can handle crime on their own. And Mboma says the deployment of federal forces makes people he knows feel less safe. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
A lot of pop stars today want to make audiences laugh. Sabrina Carpenter, Chapel Roan, Olivia Rodrigo, they are all making punchlines essential to their sound. Well, last week, a newcomer joined their ranks. I'm taking first drops in the mirror in the room. I think I look bad, so I take a hit. Her name is Audrey Hobart, and as NPR's Isabel Gomez Sarmiento reports, she's a different kind of clown.
The opening track of Audrey Hobart's debut album, Who's the Clown, came from an unlikely place.
I was home alone on a Friday night and I was watching the Apple TV Plus documentary about Steve Martin called Steve!
Well, excuse me!
I watched this whole documentary and I just was really, really, really inspired by him. And so I picked up my banjo guitar. And I was like, "What? How would I open my one-woman show?"
The result is I Like to Touch People, which also sets the tone for Hobart's album. I like to touch people. I like to touch people. It's goofy yet vulnerable, rooted in her stream of consciousness writing and nostalgic pop rock guitars. But the 26-year-old didn't set out to be a pop star. She studied screenwriting and got a job working on a Nickelodeon comedy. Then, she got pulled into writing an album with her best friend and artist, Gracie Abrams. Together, they wrote songs like That's So True, which climbed Billboard's Hot 100 chart. Hobart signed a publishing deal and started going to writing sessions for other artists. It wasn't really working.
I really admire songwriters who can get thrown in with whoever and make an amazing song. I am not that kind of writer.
So she came clean to her publisher. She wanted to make her own album. In May, the single Sue Me arrived with a splash. And being a thing is exhausting. Sue me, I wanna be wanted. Sue me, I wanna be wanted. The song quickly went viral, racking up more than 25 million streams on Spotify. Fans fell in love with Hobart's down-to-earth poptimism. But on songs like Phoebe, she also opens up about her insecurities. But it's okay, cause my life is so exciting. Every night is like a party, cause I bit the bullet. I'm finally watching Friends. While watching Friends for the first time, Hobart noticed that Phoebe Buffay is the only character not pursued romantically within the friend group.
Why doesn't any of those three main dudes want to be with her? She is the comic relief and the quirky one, and I've just always felt that way a little bit.
Who's the Clown is Audrey Hobart's one-woman show, and it establishes her as an unconventional, hilarious new voice in pop. And who cares if I'm pretty? I feel like I'm Phoebe. I feel like it totally works. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News. Work with the blue in my top, and if I tried to be her, it'd fall so flat. You'd feel badly. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine, since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com, member FDIC. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sundays 11 to 4. Registration is now open for the Itasca Orchestra Youth Strings Program. Classes begin September 15th. Learn more and register at itascaorchestra.org.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
new charges against a man accused of murdering speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman. Then, a visit to a Southwestern restaurant turned into a harrowing experience for one teen. And it could be the end of the line for the North Star Commuter Rail Service. I'm Chantel Sings. The man accused of assassinating speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman now faces even more charges. A grand jury has indicted Vance Bolter on 2 counts of first-degree premeditated murder, 4 counts of attempted first-degree murder, felony cruelty to an animal, and impersonating a police officer. The attempted first-degree murder charges are for Senator John Hoffman, his wife, his daughter, and Representative Kristen Bonner. Bolter faces the animal cruelty charge for allegedly killing the Hortman's dog. These charges are in addition to the federal charges Bolter is already facing. The new charges bring the possibility of life in prison without parole. Next, a teen in Southwest Minnesota says a restaurant employee harassed and accused her of using the wrong bathroom. As Jose Osoria reports, Buffalo Wild Wings in Owatonna now faces an official discrimination charge with the state.
We just had walked in there, and as soon as we walked in, the people were just like rude.
That's Jerrica. She's an 18-year-old high school student. What began as an unpleasant experience, full of microaggressions and disrespect, while at a Buffalo Wild Wings in Owatonna, Minnesota, in the south central part of the state, turned into a harrowing experience that would leave the teen stunned and traumatized.
We went to the bathroom, and not even 2 minutes while we were in there, the lady had came banging on the door.
The teenager initially thought that it was her friend pranking her by banging on the door. But it wasn't.
It was the B-Dubs waitress.
The incident escalated fast.
First, like, my heart had dropped because, like, I was so confused.
That's when the aggressive banging turned into so much more.
She had came in yelling, saying, "This is a woman's restroom. The man has to get out."
The waitress gave conflicting directives, telling Jerrica to get out of the restroom while not allowing her to leave the restroom, not believing the teenager's pleas that it was all a mistake.
I was like, "I am a lady." And then she was like, "You have to get out now."
Scared, trapped, and humiliated, Jerrica unzipped her hoodie to show she had breasts.
I showed her, like, I was like, "I am a girl."
Only then did the waitress back down.
She just walked out, didn't even apologize or anything.
Gender Justice is an organization established to advance gender equity through the law. Recently, they filed a charge of discrimination with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights on behalf of Jerrica. Sarah Jane Baldwin is a senior staff attorney with Gender Justice and the lead attorney on this case. She explains why the charge was filed.
The Minnesota Human Rights Act is our state civil rights law that protects people against discrimination in places like businesses or any places of public accommodations, which is anywhere that's open to the public.
Gender Justice as an organization believes that Jerrica's experience involved elements of gender policing, racial bias, and assumptions about LGBTQ plus identity.
One of the things that we are interested in doing is it sort of naming what happened, that all of these things were at play and none of them can be ignored.
Ellie Krug, a transgender activist, author, and lawyer, says that the incident is part of a broader problem in our society.
Disgust that would occur, but not necessarily surprise, because here in America right now, and people are being empowered to become gender police.
Ms. Krug says that when incidents like this happen at a place of business, it reflects on the leadership and culture of the company.
Culture leaders need to understand that they have to model for their team members.
We reached out to the corporate headquarters of Buffalo Wild Wings for comment on this incident with no response. The entire experience has left Jerrica a changed person.
Like, I'm so uncomfortable going into, like, public bathrooms now.
If the Minnesota Department of Human Rights finds that a business violated the Minnesota Human Rights Act by engaging in discrimination, it can lead to significant legal and financial consequences. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
You are listening to North Star Stories, The end of the upcoming Viking season will also likely mark the end of the line for the North Star Commuter Rail service. The Metropolitan Council wants to transition from train to bus service starting January 5th of next year. But the new bus line will not start and end in Big Lake, nor will it stop in Elk River. Instead, buses will run between Minneapolis and Ramsey and between Minneapolis and Anoka. The North Star train began running in 2009 and was supposed to connect Minneapolis to St. Cloud. But when ridership dropped during COVID, the council scrapped the extension between Big Lake and St. Cloud. The council would make a final decision later this month.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As teachers head back to school after summer break, those in small towns probably saw a lot more of their students than teachers in cities did. Laura Palmisano from member station KVNF has a story of one Colorado teacher who ended up with a summer education project without even trying.
Jacqueline Gleason has been a teacher for 3 decades. She's got a PhD in education and now teaches elementary classes in tiny Lake City, Colorado, population about 400. In the summers, she prefers gardening.
I've always done it, and I mean, it's always fun to plant a seed and watch things grow.
On Wednesday, she sells homemade goods and her surplus produce at the farmer's market in town. Today, there are 5 vendors.
Swiss chard, all the greens, because it grows so well out there. I have lots of radishes. And then all the herbs, so like basil, tarragon.
And she sometimes shares her passion for gardening with her 4th and 5th grade students.
The fact we had the worms in the classroom this year, and the kids learned about composting and feeding worms.
Just after school let out for the summer this year, one student asked if she could sell homemade earrings next to Gleason. She obliged.
Then, you know, there was another kid who wanted to, and then there was another kid, and I thought, well, you guys just need to have your own booth. And I can't say no to anybody because they're all cute little human beings.
Today, there are 5 students selling everything from painted rocks to baked goods to jewelry.
I mean, you can, like, pull them away. And yeah. They'll stretch. They stretch in water.
Judah Pankratz, a soon-to-be 5th grader, is selling bracelets he made from paracord.
I know I've made at least 200, but some of that money goes to buying new materials, new buckles, and more cord.
Gleason says having her students sell at the farmer's market allows them to continue learning when school is out. And she didn't have to write a lesson plan. It was just small town serendipity.
I think there's a lot of math skills, a lot of marketing, cooperation, collaboration, responsibility, working with people they don't know, communication.
Gleason hopes the kids are back next summer too. For NPR News, I'm Laura Palmisano in Lake City, Colorado.
Here's a question. Which animated film has made the most money at the box office? Surely something from Disney or Pixar, maybe DreamWorks? Well, what if it were a film you may never have heard of from China? Nudja 2 has now taken in more than $2.1 billion, in ticket sales worldwide. That's according to Box Office Mojo, and that breaks the records for animated films and for non-English language films. It was only over the weekend that the movie got a wider release in the U.S. with an English language dub.
You must be brave and walk your own path.
Let's bring in Jenny Zhang, who has written about this movie. She's a senior editor for Slate. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Full confession here. I have not seen this film. In fact, I didn't even know I didn't even know there was a first movie, and this is the sequel to the movie. For others out there who may be in my boat, give us a taste. What is the movie about?
It is a surprisingly complicated thing to answer. But this essentially follows this demon child, for lack of a better term, and he is sort of undergoing various trials to try to save his hometown, his friend, and getting lots of betrayals and sort of different battles throughout this whole thing as he ultimately goes up against a big bad guy who is revealed partly through the movie. So this is based on Chinese mythology, folklore, in a 16th century novel, so it is going to be very unfamiliar, I think, to lots of audiences.
What made it such a mega hit in China. An animated film about a demon child doesn't immediately strike me as something that's going to blow every existing record out of the water.
I think there are a few things going for this movie. One, it is, again, a sequel to a movie that was quite popular in China. The first movie was also a runaway hit for the filmmaker. This was his debut feature film at the time. Two, this movie came out over the Chinese New Year, which is essentially a time of the year where basically everyone in China has the week off. A lot of them are going to head to the movie theater. So that was a big draw as well.
Timing and then again, is everything.
Timing for sure. And then again, this sort of idea of it being accessible to multiple audiences, including families, including adults, including people who like animation, including fans of Chinese mythology, folklore, Chinese stories. The fact that this is actually a Chinese film, and it's an extremely Chinese film down to like the subject matter, the people who are producing it, the fact that a movie like this is being sort of now exported out from China back into the world and back into the U.S. with an English language dub, and one of the studios bringing it over is A24, which is not really known for this kind of thing. It makes it a pretty big moment and an unusual moment in cinema.
I want to dig in on the remark you just made, that this is not just a Chinese film, but an extremely Chinese film. Mm-hmm. I was looking back, the full headline of the piece you wrote about it for Slate reads, "China's biggest hit of all time is finally coming to the U.S. and Americans are already losing their minds." You didn't seem to mean that in a positive way. Explain.
You know, some of the early English language press from a lot of Western outlets on this movie earlier this year, when it was shattering all those records in China, there was a lot of sort of fallback into sort of fears about China, a lot of attributing this movie's success to this idea of like nationalism, or saying this movie is actually very anti-American and that's what is like propelling it over the line for the box office. So I found a lot of that language very interesting and something worth examining in my piece for Slate about this.
Well, I will note it did not do so great at the box office this first weekend in the U.S.
No.
$1.5 million, again, according to Box Office Mojo. Will audiences in the U.S. warm to this movie, maybe as they hear more about it? Or do you think there's something that will be lost in translation here?
I am sort of the mind, conservatively, that this is a movie that will probably just not perform that well in the U.S. and with American audiences, especially audiences who are hearing about it for the first time now. So this subject matter is just very dense, hard to follow, completely unfamiliar to most American audiences. And the fact that it is a sequel, again, to a movie that most Americans have never heard of, that is certainly not going to help it.
You've seen Nudge too. Is it any good? What do you think?
Yeah, I have seen it. It is a mixed bag, I would say. So for context, I have seen the first film as well. I did actually enjoy the first film more. The second film, it is a little bit too bloated. It's a little bit hard to follow. The conflict, the plot, there's a lot of whiplash in there. But I will say the animation is gorgeous. And so as a work of animation, and just a major work of animation for Chinese mythology in particular, it is visually stunning. So there is definitely that.
Jenny G. Zhang, senior editor for Slate. We have been talking about the film Nudge 2, out now in the States. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from PBS with Clearing the Air, The War on Smog. American Experience explores how LA's noxious smog problem led to the creation of the EPA and the Clean Air Act. Tomorrow, Tuesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend. At easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. Learn all about bats at the Zach Zim Bog Saturday, August 30th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. There will both be indoor and outdoor portions of this presentation. Registration required. Learn more at zachzim.org/events. The Friends of Lake Bemidji State Park have a pancake breakfast Sunday.